morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jeff Moyer on behalf of FMR Corp. This morning I'd like to introduce the Court to John Donovan from the Ropes & Gray firm, Boston. With the Court's permission, Mr. Donovan will be addressing the Court on behalf of FMR.
Welcome to the Court.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm representing Savor, Inc., and I'd like to introduce you this morning to Mr. Paul Quinones, who has been admitted pro hoc vici in this matter, and he will be arguing for the plaintiff this morning.
Welcome.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Paul Quinones of Harvey Pennington on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Savor, Inc. At the outset, I would like to thank this honorable court for permitting me to appear before it this morning. Your Honors, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are two areas of focus as to why the lower court erred in granting defendants' motions for summary judgment. First, substantial similarity. There is ample evidence in the record that a genuine question of material fact exists as to whether the U-Promise and Savor College Savings plans are substantially similar to support an inference of misappropriation. Second, motive and opportunity. There is ample evidence in the record that supports a finding that a genuine issue of material fact exists as to whether the U-Promise and College Savings programs were misappropriated by the defendants. The other elements of the trade secret misappropriation of trade secret claim were ruled by the lower court to be genuine issues of material fact, specifically whether or not the Savor program is itself a trade secret, and additionally whether or not Savor took reasonable measures to maintain the confidentiality of its trade secret. The narrow focus before this court, the issue is whether or not there's evidence sufficient for a reasonable jury to find that defendants misappropriated Savor's trade secret. The standard review before the court is whether or not is a de novo standard. Inferences must be viewed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. Summary judgment is not to be granted merely because the moving party appears likely or even very likely to prevail at trial.
Let's assume that we're very familiar with that black letter law and move to why the trial court erred in your view.
Yes, Your Honor. Another standard, however, to keep in mind is with respect to misappropriation of trade secret cases, however. This court, as is established by the case Smith-Klein versus Mark, stated that in most misappropriation cases, there is no smoking gun. Plaintiffs must construct a web of perhaps ambiguous circumstantial evidence from which the trier of fact may draw inferences which convince him that is more probable than not that what plaintiffs allege happened did in fact take place.
Well, let's stay with that for a moment, because that's what happened in this case. After the remand, when we got away from the motion to dismiss and into the motion for summary judgment, we have affidavits from everyone who is alleged to have violated your client's rights according to your allegation, absolutely denying they ever did anything. Then you came forward with some circumstantial evidence that you suggested raised an inference, and the trial judge looked at that and concluded that as a matter of law, that wasn't going to get you anywhere. Given that record, why wasn't it appropriate to enter summary judgment?
Well, Your Honor, I think the rest of the quotation from the Merck case is key. Against this often delicate construct of circumstantial evidence, there frequently must be balanced defendants and defendants' witnesses who deny directly everything. And in this case, the defendants' witnesses do directly deny everything. However, some case law suggests that the substantial similarity between the programs, along with other pieces of evidence, such as motive and opportunity, are enough for a fact finder to create a prima facie case of misappropriation. In this case, Your Honors, the lower court specifically ruled on substantial similarity. He ruled that as a matter of law, no reasonable fact finder could find that the programs were substantially similar. the bases for his ruling were clearly erroneous. The main reason why the lower court decided the programs were not substantially similar is that he concluded that the U-Promise program is a web-based program, whereas the Saver program is a credit card-based program. However, upon close review, these programs are actually both credit card-based programs. The Internet is just a mechanism of exchanging information, which the Saver program contemplated back in 1998, as evidenced by the fact, the undisputed fact, that it reserved domain names with respect to college savings plans. Now, the distinctions are splitting hairs, and throughout the briefing, U-Promise now admits that credit cards are required for purchases. For example, the U-Promise site is basically a portal. In order to purchase items for which the qualified rebates would go to the 529 plans, you have to use a credit card. For example, if you want to purchase something from Amazon.com, you can't pay cash. You must use a credit card. And the same is true with the U-Promise portal. Registration is required, and it is proven by the briefs. U-Promise admits that for any member to enjoy the benefits of the rebates, you have to use credit cards, and, or you can register other cards. Another distinction, however, is that both programs either use credit cards or use offline purchases, including coupons. For example, with the Saver credit card program, it was contemplated that big-ticket items, for example, the purchase of a car, you'd get $500. You wouldn't necessarily put a car on your credit card. However, you would use vouchers or coupons so that the actual purchase could be tracked and reconciliation could take place at the Saver site. Additionally, the credit card report, the Saver credit card function, while important, is just one of many unique elements comprising the Saver program. And that testimony comes out of the Keenan expert report, which was submitted with the Saver ITS, the identification of the trade secret. Additionally, if you look at what U-Promise has presented, specifically the Winnig affidavit, which is located at A773 and 774, he describes the U-Promise program as family purchases on and offline. So the emphasis on whether or not Saver, U-Promise, is strictly web-based is not as clear as defendants make it out to be. Additionally, it is true that U-Promise must issue some sort of cards and identification so that these purchases can be tracked. And that's at A1017, where U-Promise states that it operates through the issuance of member cards or similar devices as identification through registration of credit cards. Another additional point and another similarity which is undisputed is that both Saver and U-Promise issue co-branded credit cards. Not only do they issue co-branded credit cards, but exactly 1% of qualified purchases are credited towards the consumer's account. And additionally, the other facts which the court below as well as defendants still do not address are really much to a reasonable fact finder would not be just mere coincidences. For example, the designating of a rebate of between 1 to 3 cents per gallon of every gas purchased, the specifically designating a rebate for $5 for hotel night stays, designating a rebate of exactly 10% of monthly telephone bills, the use of exactly 5, not 4, 2, or 1, but college scholarships as a means of marketing the program. None of these points are addressed by the lower court or by the defendants, and Saver submits to this court that all of these similarities are enough for a reasonable fact finder to find that a substantial similarity between the programs exists. Additionally, a novel innovative feature that U-Promise tried to patent is a double loyalty credit feature, and that's at A34 to 37 in the Saver program compared to A663, 664, as well as 1018 of the U-Promise programs. The double loyalty credit feature indicates that if you make a purchase using a Saver card or a U-Promise co-branded credit card, you get the 1% for using that card, but also making qualified purchases through specific merchants, you'd also get that rebate.
What do you mean by a You Promise co-branded credit card?
Yes, Your Honor. Any company can't just issue a card. A bank must be involved in order to issue a credit card. In this case, You Promise has a credit card with Citibank. Saver had its own credit card with United National Bank. That's what is the co-branded nature of the cards. And it's interesting to point out that
did Saver's plan contemplate credits for the consumer other than from a credit card issued by Saver?
Yes, Your Honor. Saver contemplated issuing registration of other credit cards or debit cards, which would be able to purchases through the use of those.
Without any co-branding relationship?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what was the timing of that vis-a-vis You Promise's development of that same pattern?
Well, Your Honor, the registration and contemplation of credit cards as well as debit cards in the Saver program was disclosed and was contemplated as of 1998 when Saver disclosed its trade secret to FMR. You Promise didn't, and there's no dispute that You Promise didn't even start brainstorming anything until March of 1999, months later after the disclosure of...
The trial court seemed to find that as a matter of fact that there's no dispute that was just a common throughout the industry, that a lot of people were doing that. Just off the top of my head, what about Discover Card? It has a similar kind of relationship where you get rebates on your card for cash for purchases made, but with the card at different locations. What was so different about the Saver plan that You Promise expropriated it?
Well, as stated in Discovery, as well as the Keenan Expert Report, which identifies how the Saver program is unique. One of the reasons why the Saver program is unique versus the Discover Card, for instance, is that the linkage between college savings and affinity marketing, and even Mr. Fadul's affidavit, you look at it, says that is the heart of the E-Promise program, is the linking between college savings and affinity marketing. With the Discover Card, you get 1% cash back. That goes to you. In both the Saver and the U-Promise programs, and this is admitted by Claude, the key witness here, as well as numerous other parties, is that in both instances, you have affinity marketing tied to college savings, and specifically 529 tax-sheltered plans. That's the draw to the program, is that after Doyle did market research, people didn't necessarily want to have savings for themselves. They wanted to have them for their kids or grandkids. Which is another novel aspect of the Saver program, which appears in the You Promise program, is that you can have other people deposit money, not just direct family members, but you can register other people, friends and relatives, and they can make purchases through registration of their credit cards and designate that your child as a beneficiary. Another novel feature that You Promise tried to patent, actually, and it's interesting that in the patent application, several Saver features appear, is an additional deposit of money. The Saver program contemplated a plus 10 option wherein consumers could deposit additional monies, for example, paying an extra amount on their balance, which would be deposited directly into their Saver account. And You Promise permits that as well, where you can pay additional amounts, which are independent of any purchases, into your beneficiary's account.
Why is this statement by the trial judge incorrect? And I quote, "The record reveals that the Saver revenue model relied heavily upon the fees generated in connection with the issuance of its Saver credit card. Conversely, You Promise did not rely principally on credit card fees. Its revenue is derived from payments made by merchant and financial service partners." Is that an incorrect statement about the record?
I would say that's incorrect, Your Honor.
Well, tell me why, because arguably, standing alone, that constitutes a substantial difference in the plan.
Yes, Your Honor. At A41, which is the ITS, Saver designates, and this is verified by the client, by Dennis Doyle, what is the revenue model for Saver. Vendors pay Saver a percentage of the rebate offered. A bank licensee would pay Saver a fee for each new card issue. Saver would be paid a percentage of all credit card purchases. And Saver would be 529 managers, such as Fidelity, would pay a certain amount to Sabre for each new account opened, and these are identical as the EU Promise program. What's strange about the lower court's opinion is that the lower court states that it's not clear where Sabre gets its money, but it's different from EU Promise. But there's no reason how you can say that it's not clear how it makes money, but it's different.
Well, it's clear to me that what the trial court found was that Sabre's plan was to principally get its revenues from its own credit card, but EU Promise principally relied upon its revenue from merchant and financial service partners and not from its own issued or co-branded credit card. That's my question. Is that emphasis by the trial court, that finding, which seems to be very prominent in its ultimate conclusion that there's substantial differences between the two plans, is that incorrect as a matter of fact?
I would say yes, Your Honor. That would be an argument before the fact finder to a jury. Are these, how they make money, is that different? Is that a material difference? Is that a substantial difference? Sabre would argue that these are substantially similar because the vendors are still paying Sabre or EU Promise for purchases made.
I seem to have taken you into your rebuttal time just to make sure you are aware of that. You can continue on or save your time, whichever you'd like.
Your Honors, I'd like to continue briefly. An additional key point with respect to substantial similarity, and this is undisputed as well, is that even if EU Promise used only portions or elements of the Sabre program, EU Promise would still be liable for misappropriation. And the rationale is simple. If you steal somebody's program, but perhaps change one element, you should still be liable for misappropriation. You can't just change one thing and say, now that they're different, our hands are clean.
Well, that's why the term is substantially different, isn't it?
Correct, Your Honor. And I think that with respect to discussions as to how these programs operate, it's a fact-intensive analysis, which should be for the trier of fact, which in this case should be the jury, Your Honor. A key case to remember is Camelot, and this is the only case which we have found which discusses this triangular relationship where a plaintiff discloses its trade secret to one party, that party A discloses it to party B. And in that case, the Eastern District of Pennsylvania stated that there was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether or not the misappropriation occurred between Party A and Party B. And those are the same facts that we have here. In terms of motive and opportunity, FMR had the motive of being able to manage billions of dollars in 529 accounts. EU Promise stated that. And that's located at A1304A to 1304B. EU Promise would get fees for every member enrolled in its program, as well as participating merchants. For the individuals involved, Fadul was given a lucrative reward. He was awarded for his disclosure with a salary and substantial stock benefits. Claude had a motive to transfer that information to Fadul to make EU Promise successful because it'd be a larger revenue stream back to FMR and make his department more successful. Again, to stress that what are not at issue before the court is whether or not Sabre program is a trade secret and whether or not it took reasonable measures to maintain the confidentiality of its trade secret. Your Honor, I'd like to conclude and reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is John Donovan from Ropes & Gray. I represent FMR Corp. FMR is the parent of the number of businesses known as Fidelity Investment. As you know, the issue with respect to FMR is that it is said to be the instrument of transmission of the ostensible trade secret between Sabre through Mr. Doyle and ultimately to EU Promise. That raises, obviously, several questions, including how did the transmission occur? There is no dispute that, in fact, Mr. Doyle disclosed something to Mr. Claude. But then the question is, what did he disclose to Mr. Claude? Was it a trade secret? And was something then disclosed from someone at FMR, ultimately to EU Promise? The logic of the plaintiff's position is where the trial court found the absence of material issues of fact, or genuine issues of fact, to put before a jury. If you examine, because as Mr. Kinnell has just said, the question with respect to FMR is its ostensible motive and opportunity to transmit something to UPromise. And when I say something, I think that's important. We have focused, and Mr. Kinnell has just focused upon the so-called Save More plan. The plan for the operation of the business, however, and the manner in which UPromise now operates its business is not the question. The question instead is whether what was transmitted and what was ultimately appropriated was a trade secret. And the trade secret is said to be a unique compilation of designs, processes, ideas, marketing techniques, and the rest. So the mere fact that one coincidence of the Sabor program appears in the UPromise program does not permit an inference that what was transmitted was what was required to be transmitted, which is the entire trade secret, the unique compilation, the combination of things put together in their unique manner such that they can constitute a trade secret. If you examine then the logic that is relied upon by Sabor to advance the proposition that there was transmission, the mere fact that there was a motive, say ultimately to have a relationship with UPromise and managed 529 accounts, cannot be sufficient, nor can a mere opportunity. But if you examine them in turn, what is the evidence upon which that motive or opportunity is said to be based, again, you cannot find a material issue of fact. What is the opportunity? Well, the evidence is that the only person at FMR who could have had knowledge of the Sabor trade secret, not program, trade secret, is Mr. Claude. Well, did he transmit it to anyone? He says no. Is there evidence he transmitted it to anyone? No. Is there anyone at UPromise who said he got it? No. Is there anyone else at Fidelity who said, I know it and I transmitted it? No. Is there even anyone at Fidelity who says, I knew something about it? No. So what is the evidentiary argument that Sabor advances? It's that Fadulu was present for a short period of time, maybe 4 to 6 weeks, at the same time that Claude worked there, and 18 months later, Fadulu winds up at UPromise. Would that permit an inference of communication between Claude, the only one with knowledge in his head, and UPromise? I suggest as a matter of logic, no. But examine the hypothesis that Sabor advances, because their hypothesis was Claude to Fadul to UPromise. That founders, Your Honors, on the temporal sequence, because even if you accept that at some point, with no evidence, that because Claude and Fadul's tenure overlapped for 6 weeks, when the knowledge was, without dispute, in Claude's head, when and how, under what circumstances, could Fadul have transmitted the information to UPromise? Well, we know that Claude did not connect with UPromise at all between September 98, when he met with Doyle, and April 99, when the undisputed evidence in the record is of independent development of the UPromise program by Mr. Bronner at UPromise. So in that sequence, in that approximately 6 months, you have nothing, not one scintilla of evidence to suggest transmission, communication, contact, anything between any FMR employee and UPromise. Again, the missing link is Fadul. Well, where's Fadul this time? Fadul doesn't connect to UPromise until January or February of 2000. Now, 9 months after, again, the only evidence is the independent development of the UPromise idea by Mr. Bronner. I suggest to you that Judge Slides correctly found that that evidence of independent development cut off any possibility of a suggestion that the hypothesis, Claude to Fadul to UPromise, was the instrument of transmission. Then explain motive. Well, to be sure, the evidence is that ultimately, at some point in 2001, Fidelity and UPromise did enter a business relationship of what turns out to have been short duration. Well, that might supply a motive for Fidelity at some point to have said something to UPromise. The problem is, again, the temporal sequence cuts that off. UPromise came up with its idea before that business relationship was even contemplated. But that isn't the theory. The theory is the transmission was quad to fidual to UPromise. Ask yourself this question. What conceivable motive would Fidelity have had to cause Fidul, no longer its employee, nowhere to be seen so far as Fidelity knew, to transmit the information to UPromise? That, of course, raises a legal question, apart from a factual question. How could Fidelity be responsible for the transmission by Fidul to UPromise, again, the temporal sequence is off, at a time when he wasn't their employee, within the scope of his employment, for all you know, he's on a lark of his own. That, in fact, was what Judge Leitz referred to as the elastic quality of the arguments that Sabre would raise. This case started, this dispute started in 2000. A newspaper article appeared in which UPromise disclosed that it was contemplating starting business and hoped to sign on Fidelity. Mr. Doyle, at that point, on one news article, before he even knew about Fidul, sent a letter, "It's my idea." Well, I suggest that reveals a couple of things. Either that's hip shooting of the worst sort, or it reveals that an inference can't truly exist of dissemination of a trade secret if he's shooting that cease and desist bullet at a time before the program is even up and running. Even if you indulge the notion that circumstantial evidence is what is required in a trade secrets case for a plaintiff to prevail, think about how, if you remand this case, a trial could conceivably occur. What would Sabre do to, in fact, put out evidence sufficient to make out for a jury and get over the rail and preponderate with respect to its alleged motive and opportunity on the part of FMR to transmit the information? Well, he couldn't put Claude in the stand, because he would say, "I was the only guy who knew it. I didn't tell, and I wasn't there at a time I could tell." They couldn't put Fidul in the stand, because he would say, "I didn't know, and I didn't tell, and I wasn't there at a time I could have told." Could they put on any other Fidelity employee? Every precipient witness at Fidelity would say, "I didn't know, couldn't have known, and wasn't in the position to know." That, Your Honors, would leave Sabre arguing to the jury that the only basis upon which to conclude a motive and opportunity existed is for you to disbelieve Mr. Claude, Mr. Fidul, and everyone else the plaintiff has to put in the stand. Disbelief is not the basis for affirmative proof. Now, in fact, Your Honors, I'd suggest that even Sabre's brief in this court and their most recent brief in the reply tells you that the absence of logic to the inference that they have to create is missing. At page 8 of their reply, they put the pieces together and they say that, no, their theory of transmission has never been just Claude to Fidul to UPromise, and the lower court never limited them. Well, of course, the lower court never limited them. They had to come up with proof of their own. But they then say that it could have happened some other way. You know, plaintiff has consistently maintained only that the sequence happened after the Doyle to Claude transmission in September 98. That's what they say. We have always maintained it happened after that. The non sequitur is the next sentence. Thus, well, the mere fact of transmission to FMR establishes nothing. But I think thus that establishes that there is a genuine issue of fact. Well, upon what evidence? And the coup de grace is the last phrase of that very sentence, in which they say the trade secret could have been transferred. An inference in logic requires more than mere possibility, more than the mere potential to happen.
Thank you.
Could have happened is not enough. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Erwin Schwartz. I want to thank the Court for permitting me to argue pro hoc. It is an honor and a privilege. I can't resist following up on something that the Chief Justice was asking about, which was this revenue model that Judge Slouch found, so important. Mr. Quionis cited the court to the last page of what has been called the ITS. It's A41 in the record. And one of the points that we made, and I think Judge Slouch agreed, is that there needs to be evidence for these revenue model arguments. That last page of the ITS is without citation to the what we call Exhibit A, what they claim they gave to FMR, which ultimately was a trade secret that found its way to UPromise. The verification, which is the so-called evidentiary basis of those statements, was submitted, it was 60 days later. It's a sweeping verification that shows no knowledge on the part of Mr. Doyle as to those specific representations, or that in fact those specific representations were conveyed to Mr. Claw. One of the problems, it almost is in the nature of water torture here, is that they compare what they call their program with what is, you know, objective, the way UPromise works. And elasticity is Mr. Donovan's word. Every time they could point at how UPromise works and say, well, ours would have worked that way. Their program would have worked that way. But what I respectfully suggest Judge Slouch did and what this court should do on a de novo basis is say, where is the evidence of the trade secret in that, quote, program? Because it's very easy for lawyers 5 years later to write a narrative about what that program would have been. But respectfully, that's not what the substantial similarity test should compare. It should compare the trade secret that was purportedly conveyed to FMR and UPromise's program that they that the record establishes. Now, the substantial similarity test is, in fact, very important and a little bit vexing here because it comes up in two ways. The only, quote, evidence that they have that that trade secret that went to FMR came to UPromise, so evidence of transmission, circumstantial evidence, is their claimed similarity between the two. If you go back and you look at Merck and you go back and you look at Miles, the substantial similarity test in those cases was applied relating to whether or not the trade secret was used by the defendants. So substantial similarity or similarity, at least strikes me, can come up in two different ways as the court works through the matrix of a trade secret analysis. In this case, it comes up both as circumstantial evidence that UPromise received it, because nothing else shows that UPromise, there's no evidence in the record that nothing in UPromise's files, there's nothing that shows UPromise got this Exhibit A. And then, later on, if the court finds that UPromise did receive it, then there's a question of whether or not UPromise's program is substantially similar to that trade secret. Now, the Chief Justice asked, well, you know, what is, isn't it, is it substantially similar, substantially different? Maybe I'm not paraphrasing properly, but I'd like to get at the nub of that. This is a compilation trade secret. They admit that big pieces of this are in the public domain, that big pieces of it, like it uses the internet, are common business practice, which on themselves could not be protectable. Yet they say that it's the amalgamation of all those things that was given to FMR and then came to UPromise, which is their evidence that UPromise got it. Well, obviously, if you then pick and choose these publicly available things and compare them and say, ah, they're substantially similar, both programs had a business plan. That's one of their reasons for saying that UPromise should be liable, absent any other evidence that UPromise received this. Both programs were going to use the internet. Another reason. I respectfully suggest that that's not the right test. That, in fact, if a plaintiff is going to try to use substantial similarity as circumstantial evidence of transmission as opposed to of misuse, that, and it's a compilation, that they need to prove that the entire trade secret, each and every piece of it, at some point in time, made it from FMR to UPromise. To pick and choose some aspects would then subject, without doing it all, would then subject UPromise to potential liability for taking business school basics, as Jim Carroll argued, I think, before the court 4 years ago on this, and applying liability to UPromise for using the internet, for using affinity marketing, which the court's well aware of with the Discover card or with the Citibank aviation card or any of these other things. What Judge Slice did, I think, to try to deal with this problem, and this makes a lot of sense to me, is he said, well, let's eliminate all of the elements of the You Promise program that could not have been learned from FMR. Let's screen all of the aspects that Saber points that says they're similar and say, well, wait a second, You Promise came up with this before Badul was ever hired by You Promise. And that should be eliminated from the calculation. Let's eliminate all the things that were in the American Banker article, which was published before You Promise was ever alleged to have stolen anything. And let's eliminate the very common sense aspects and see if there's a kernel of uniqueness that was in the Saver program the Saver trade secret that was conveyed to FMR that somehow made it to You Promise. And when he did all that, which I thought he did a tremendous job, he came up with not only that there was no such kernel, but that what was left was very different. The revenue model, for example, different. You know, you can't, if you've been watching sports this time of year or most TV, you can't avoid the mantra of this credit card advertisement that says, what's in your wallet? Well, that answers this question, because in fact, the evidence in this case says to take advantage of the Saver program, you need a Saver card in your wallet. Judge Slice got it absolutely right. For You Promise, the evidence here is that you could use a variety of methodologies to take advantage of that college savings program. You know, I also invite your clerks, if they have the chance, to take a look at what the evidence is in the record that purportedly Saver could register any credit card. I know the Chief Justice asked about this, and Mr. Polonis answered.
We, in general, look at the record ourselves.
I just prefer the court to the actual two pages from that Exhibit A that refer to anything other than a Saver card, and that's A156. It's actually three pages, 156 to 158. Those refer to a program known as iDine, which is a credit card-based program where you can go into a restaurant, use any registered credit card, and get a discount. Look closely, because the dates on the documents, it says the iDine card will not be effective, I think it says after July 1, 2000. July 1, 2000 would indicate that that document was created after the time that Doyle purportedly gave the information to FMR. There's nothing credible that shows that that piece of paper, which was the only hook upon which Saver claims that its credit card or its program to work with other credit cards, was ever given to FMR or ever made its way through to You Promise. I see I've just about run out of time, so let me just take a moment to check my notes. Let me just talk for a minute about substantial identity, because Judge Slice actually adopted that phrase, I think, from a case out of the Federal District Court here in Delaware, Callaway versus Dunlop. And the actual language, substantial identity, comes out of that case, applied California law, comes out of the California courts, but it applies to the analysis under the California Trade Secret Act for this very thing we're talking about. And what it says is, and I don't really think there's a difference between substantial identity and substantial similarity, but what it says is that the court should undertake an exacting analysis to find out whether or not the trade secret made it from from the plaintiff through to the defendant. In this case, I'd say that Judge Jordan did that in the Callaway case and did a very thorough job. And in this case, Judge Slice did the same thing. He applied a screen that we've talked about and looked for any kernel that could have demonstrated the transmission from Saver to Fidelity to You Promise. I suggest that to hold that substantial similarity requires any less would be to allow any plaintiff to reach into their desk drawer, find a pack of really random violence, claim that's a trade secret, and then impute that to a defendant. Here, there was nothing to show that You Promise received money. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I would like to focus on two things. First, the facts. First, on substantial similarity. What the Gore Court erred in doing was discussing what could not have been misappropriated based on time, based upon an undated you promise document, and that's at A1154. So it's unsure whether or not those elements were in you promise as of July 2000. Additionally, let's talk about facts. It's then undisputed that Claude and Fadul both worked in the same department. Fadul was Claude's supervisor. Claude kept the saver information in the locked drawer, but he doesn't know what he did with it. Additionally, Claude and Fadul kept seeing each other at industry meetings after Fadul left.
I'm not sure I understand that. He kept it in a locked drawer, but he's not sure what he did with it?
That's correct, Your Honor. We asked him what
he kept it in a locked drawer, right?
But he doesn't know where it is now or what he did with it afterwards, Your Honor. Additionally, as of June 1999...
And he kept it in the locked drawer during the relevant time that Fadul was there. Is that what you're...
And afterwards. He's not sure when...
Well, didn't he also testify that he probably destroyed it?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. Additionally, as of June 1999, after Fadul left, Claude still has his appointment notes, and this is at A627, 628, as indicating that he's doing some work on the Saber card. Additionally, after the lawsuit is filed, just as a reasonable jury could conclude, FMR's CIT members, Nottinson and Conway, concluded that Fadul must have been implicated in the transmission of the Saber trade secret, since he is the common denominator, and that's at A1951-53. Your Honor, I see that my time is... coming to a close, so I'll briefly conclude. Your Honor, when we last convened in September 2002, during the appeal of the lower court's granting of the defendant's 12B6 motions, Judge Berger asked during oral argument, aren't you simply asking for your day in court? The question and the answer remain true. Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.